the U.S. Navy ship, Dolphin, to the Spanish-speaking city he had visited nearly 20 years earlier. But amid the tensions and adventures of his minister's duties, tragic news arrived from back home in Washington. Relentlessly, death continued to visit the extended Douglas family. The Douglases got the news before Christmas. Virginia Hewlett Douglas, for 20 years the wife of Frederick Jr., died after an extended illness. In handwritten notes preserved in scrapbooks, Frederick Jr. recorded that his wife was taken with hemorrhage on October 18th. At Virginia's death, their 4-year-old son, Robert Smalls Douglas, was sent to live with Hattie Sprague, where he remained for more than a year and a half, the 23-year-old second daughter of Rosetta. 4 of Frederick Jr.'s 6 children had already died young. He was now once again in dire straits, as well as mourning for his 41-year-old wife. In that same December, he ceased keeping his detailed personal account book. That fall, Frederick Jr. had received yet 3 more loans totaling $130 from his father. Frederick Jr., not in good health himself now at the age of 49, seems to process his confusion and grief in numbing, if settling, mathematical detail of his account books and in his notes about Virginia's death. "We were married 20 years, 6 months, and 10 days," he wrote in careful words on December 21st, 1889. She was 40 years, 6 months, and 13 days old at the time of her death. She was married 4 months and 10 days longer than she remained single. In Port-au-Prince that winter, Douglas may have stopped counting these deaths in his family as he felt the grief all over again for his son and his children. In less than 3 months came yet more bad news. Mary Louise Douglas, the 16-year-old only surviving daughter of Charles, died in early March. This made 4 of Charles' 5 children who had died in their youth. In a letter from Haiti, Douglas wrote to his son about death. "The blow is a sad one to us all, but we must suffer and be strong. I feel deeply for you because yours has been a most bitter experience. Few families have been made to suffer as yours has in the loss of dear ones, but your experience should make you strong. You are still young and have, I hope, much of life and usefulness before you. It is not for you to despair." Charles had heard this form of fatherly advice and anguish before. Like his brothers, Charles' grief was compounded by his long-term indebtedness to his father. Just as Douglas received his appointment to go to Haiti, Charles had written a deeply despondent letter to his father about being in arrears on his rent in a house for which the elder had staked his son the money. Charles's only surviving son, 20-year-old Joseph, a skilled violinist, was in Boston studying music at costs Charles could no longer afford, and for which he also reached to his father for help. For 10 years, Charles lamented, he had tried to make ends meet and pay everybody something. He was once again without a steady job and hoped to find one through connections to the Grand Army, the Union Veterans Organization. "I shall pay you, Father, and it is not from dishonesty that I am behind." The great voice of emancipationist Civil War memory and of Union veterans respect must at times have felt anguish at the chasm between this national cause and the plight of his own sons. Only Louis, who had no children due to his war wounds, seems to have developed a genuinely independent life. By June, to avoid the repressive tropical heat, Douglas requested a leave to return home for the duration of the summer. He was fully aware now that he was at the center of an internal struggle in the Harrison administration, involving Navy officers and merchants as well, over the American quest for foreign expansion in an age of empire. He still believed, against the tide, that Haiti was a place where those impulses could be tamed or restrained and made into a force for freedom. Douglas sailed for home with Helen on July 20th, 1890, with rumors already at large about his possible resignation from the position as minister. As he and Helen waited at the New York train station for their journey to Washington, a New York Tribune reporter cornered Douglas to query him about his experience in Haiti. The minister tried to decline political questions, but pressed by the reporter, he came to Haiti's defense. The Hippolyte regime sat as firmly seated as at any former time. Douglas strongly cautioned against the assumption that Haiti was always on the verge of chaos and incapable of self-government. There is one thing in which the people of the United States could help the Haitians, by telling the truth about them, and not having them constantly paraded before the world as on the eve of revolution. He denounced the notion that he had been ostracized as a colored man in Port-au-Prince. Indiscreetly, Douglas warned of the impression in the island nation that the United States is very anxious to get possession of Haiti. He claimed that some of our papers had created the impression, but he also knew that acquiring at least the Mall Saint-Nicolas harbor was the intention at the highest levels of American government and business. Douglas knew of what he spoke about American attitudes toward Haiti. He had endured an ugly piece of doggerel about himself back in March by an unknown poet published in the New York Herald. "Will you come back to us, Douglas, 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 tender and true? Is it a hated isle of Haiti? Is it true they'll have none of you? Can't we get that mole St. Nicholas Douglas, Frederick Douglas, tender and true? As there are cannibals still in Haiti, aren't you afraid that they may eat you? Tender hearts have been known to beat well under a sable skin as a buff. Ministers have been known to eat well. Look out, Douglas, tender or tough." Far more respectful, the Black Paper New York Age sent a reporter to interview Douglas immediately after his return to Cedar Hill. The Age called him the Venerable Moses of his race and pointed to his concern about what Haiti might have done to his health. "Time is telling on me," said the tired Douglas, only hours off the train, "and the 10 months in Haiti have made my step less firm." Again, he defended Haiti's 87 years of revolutionary heritage in a world of hostility. Douglas's leave of 2 months turned into 4, in large part because of a struggle within the administration. Blaine, Secretary of the Navy, and former Civil War General Benjamin F. Tracy, and an American businessman with ravenous interests in Haiti, William P. Clyde, all either opposed or were at least suspicious of Douglas's return as minister. They did not trust the old abolitionist's dedication to expansion, especially the quest for Mont Saint-Nicolas. Still roiling among them was their desire for a white ambassador for their schemes. President Harrison seems to have played the key role in not only sustaining Douglas, but in moderating the imperialism of his chief aides and their clients. Harrison did, however, appoint Admiral Gherardi to cooperate as special commissioner with Douglas in the looming negotiations with the Haitian government, setting up an ultimately untenable arrangement. The president's official instructions to Gherardi, Harrison made it clear that he sought to acquire a coaling station for the United States in West India waters, but that it should be accomplished by a lease rather than by seizure of land. The idea of a lease on the mole served as a vain American hope of circumventing Haitian sovereignty. Douglas had no intention of resigning his position during this leave period. At a large gathering at the Black Methodist camp, Wayman's Grove, outside Baltimore, he denounced those urging his resignation. "At them I fling the old adage, few die and none resign. I am going back." He and Helen returned to Haiti under these diplomatic challenges on December 13, 1890. As they arrived in the harbor at Port-au-Prince, President Hippolyte sent 2 officers to meet them and drive them in his personal carriage to their residence. Douglas reported good order in the capital and progress in conditions, especially the erection of numerous buildings for stores and dwellings. He also expressed great optimism about the imminent completion of the telegraph cable from Mont Saint-Nicolas to all the great centers of modern civilization. Both he and Helen were glad to be back among the flowering winter hibiscus. But soon, the coaling station negotiations began to run into trouble, despite Douglas's good relationship with Haitian Foreign Minister Firmin. On New Year's Day, 1891, Firmin paid a visit to Douglas's home. The 2 had a frank exchange, with Firmin condemning a report in a New York paper claiming that Hippolyte had made a promise to allow the United States possession of Mont Saint-Nicolas. With some feeling, Douglas reported, Fiamin denied any such promise. The U.S. minister did his best to support his counterpart's disdain for the scurrilous and jingoistic American press, something they shared. But he also told Fiamin that his country was very willing to acquire by any proper means, by lease, rent, purchase, or any other way, the coveted coaling station. Douglas also reported, however, that he left this meeting not sanguine of receiving any immediate encouragement in negotiating for the mall. Admiral Gherardi was about to arrive and all but subvert the minister's best intentions, and Douglas had lost Fiamin's trust. Among Douglas's nemesis now, in the troubled diplomatic relationship, was William Clyde, the steamship line owner who tried to negotiate his own elaborate deal with Ipoli's government, offering arms and ships for a monopoly on Haitian trade. Clyde attacked Douglas as soft and an obstacle to enterprise. The magnate pressed Douglas to help him seal the deal and get the Haitians to pay him for his time and money expended in establishing the trade line. But the minister, dropping any diplomatic pose, told the businessman no, while plunging a dagger into his integrity. "Then, sir, as they will not allow you to put a hot poker down their backs, you mean to make them pay you for heating it." Douglas later wrote that Clyde had viewed him as more a Haitian than an American. Douglas described himself as both surprised and amused by Clyde's greed and bad manners. Douglas admitted that he actually supported the idea of a steamship line, but had nothing but disgust for the method by which this scheme was pressed upon Haiti. Events and Douglas's own attempts to find middle paths to agreements that were out of reach painted him into a corner. Admiral Gherardi's warship, the Philadelphia, anchored in Port-au-Prince Harbor on January 25, 1891. The next day, Douglas met with the admiral on board and read Blaine's, and therefore President Harrison's, instructions to seek and obtain the mall as a coaling station. Douglas, Gherardi, and an interpreter met at the palace with Ipoli and Fiamin 2 days later. Since it had been made clear to Douglas that Gherardi was to be his superior in this negotiation, he unfortunately let the admiral dominate the exchanges over the lease. Gherardi sowed the seeds of ultimate failure by stressing the promises made by Ipoli's original provisional government to pay back the United States in some way for the arms and assistance given it as he took over Haiti in 1889. Fiamin respectfully disagreed that there were any such promises, although the Haitian foreign minister did acknowledge that the request for the coaling station was a simple application from one friendly power to another. Unwittingly, Gherardi may have doomed his cause when he claimed to Fiamin and Ipoli that it was the destiny of the mall to belong to the United States. No other power would be allowed to occupy it, even though the government of Haiti should cede it. That word, destiny, surely clanged in the ears of the Haitians as it was translated. The Americans left the meeting thinking they might have a deal. Any hope of the deal, however, collapsed within 2 months. A negotiation had quickly become a demand by an admiral backed up by warships arriving in Haitian ports. In later public writings, Douglas distanced himself from Gherardi as he also condemned Clyde. Douglas felt trapped, or as he put it, a servant between two masters. Negotiations faltered when Ipoli left Port-au-Prince at the end of February for nearly 2 months to quell a rebellion in Jacmel in the south of the island. Moreover, in March, some New York newspapers began to attack Douglas for the apparent failure of American interests in Haiti. "The remedy for any further revolution," said the New York Herald, "is clear. Let the United States send to Haiti a minister of recognized force, ability, and above all, honesty. He must be able to speak the French language. To gain any influence in the island, he must be white, because Haitians look upon a colored man as one of themselves, whereas they unwittingly recognize the superiority of the white race." Douglas was caught in contradictions of his own making, as well as in historical contexts over which he had little control. What he had learned, as he later wrote, was that Haitians would not tolerate alienation of a single rod of their territory to a foreign power. He also knew he faced a growing cadre of enemies in the rear at home. By mid-April, the U.S. naval presence reached 7 warships, which caused considerable alarm among Haitians. But the show of force did not work. Girardi favored use of force to obtain them all. Douglas, however, broke with his co-negotiator. In a message to Blaine, he denied, in terms as explicit as usages of diplomatic correspondence will permit, that he in any way favored seizure, as Girardi had implied. By April 21st, Douglas reported to the State Department that the presence in this harbor of our war vessels has created a feeling of apprehension, anxiety beyond anything of the kind that I have ever before personally known to exist here. Rumors of war and an American military takeover flew around Haiti. On that same day, Douglas, with Bassett as his translator, and Girardi met with Firmin to make one more official appeal for the lease of the mole. Firmin's written reply on the next day deftly captured the reality. The American request included a clause that so long as the United States remained the lessee of Mole Saint-Nicolas, Haiti could not dispose of any port or harbor or other territory in its dominions or grant any special privileges or rights of use therein to any other power, state, or government. This offending language, Firmin argued, was an outrage on the national sovereignty of the Republic and a flagrant violation of Article 1 of our Constitution, for in renouncing the right to dispose of its territory, it would tacitly consent to the alienation of it. Douglas thus saw the crux of the failure. As he later wrote, the U.S. demand to exclusive rights to Haitian ports was a denial to all others of that which we claimed for ourselves. He chastised his fellow American policymakers for their refusal to grasp Haitian history. Her fierce territorial sensitivities originated, he wrote, very naturally in the circumstance in which Haiti began her national existence. She, by her bravery and her blood, was free. With warships in the harbor, the negotiation became impossible. We appeared before the Haitians, Douglas said later, when out of office and before the world with the pen in one hand and the sword in the other. In Haiti's entire national history, it had been menaced by imperial powers. Now the United States acted like one of those powers. On April 23rd, Douglas sent a telegram to Blaine with a simple statement, Haiti has declined the lease of Mole. Douglas made his case even in formal dispatches to his boss in Washington. On May 3rd, he wrote to Blaine about passionate Haitian press accounts calling for resistance to the presence of U.S. ships in the island's harbors. He told Blaine and official Washington what they did not want to hear. The United States had bullied its way to this diplomatic debacle. Slowly but surely, Douglas became a defender of Haiti more than an advocate for his own country's policy, a contradiction he could only sustain for a short while longer. By May 1891, Frederick and Helen Douglas witnessed a bloody Haitian riot and rebellion against the Hippolyte regime. As early as May 7th, Douglas warned the State Department of signs of incipient revolution and a conspiracy to overthrow Hippolyte. On May 28th, during the Feast of Corpus Christi, a major Catholic holiday, as Haitians packed churches and President Hippolyte and his ministers attended a service in a cathedral, a band of some 70 armed rebels stormed down from mountains above the city, attacked the jail, and released more than 100 prisoners. Then the rebels dashed to attack the arsenal, but were repulsed. The initial uprising lasted just over a half hour, but the whole city was thrown into an uproar, the minister reported to Washington. Like everyone else in Port-au-Prince, the Douglases were initially terrified by the violence. They dragged furniture to block their doors and heard stray bullets that were flying past. Douglas described hearing a sharp street fight and reported that Hippolyte himself took to the streets on horseback to lead the reprisals, ordering and participating in the killings. Bassett and Douglas did not find each other until evening at a hotel veranda, whereupon they fled to safety after hearing the firing of a Gatling gun. The killings that day by government troops were rather indiscriminate. Helen Douglas wrote, "The air was rent by the wailings from various cottages, of women bereft of those they loved. In the wake of the uprising, there were many accounts of summary executions, as well as of the torture and killing of prisoners in custody. For a time, the scent of gunpowder replaced the fragrance of Haitian flowers. Some have suggested that in his reporting on the violence, Douglas demonstrated an undue coziness with the police regime, to which he needed a relationship, and that he was just too naive about the prospects of a black-led government. The police court, as it was called in the American press, shimmered with the trappings of pomp and circumstance that Douglas may have admired. When the president went into public for official matters, according to an engineer on Girardi's ship, he surrounded himself with a detail of nearly 30 sharply uniformed military aides. Douglas's failure, as it became widely viewed, in leading the Mont Saint-Nicolas strategy in Haiti, was not due merely to naivete. It was rooted in fundamental contradictions that he both embraced and ultimately rejected. But it may also have been simply one episode among many in the United States' approach to Haiti in the late 19th century. According to historian Michel Rolfe Troyon, American foreign policy leaders in Washington, and even the members of the black elite, such as Douglas, never fully integrated themselves into the social and cultural practices, including how color determined status, within the island nation. German and French merchants and diplomats, Trio asserts, developed deeper personal and economic ties than the Americans by marrying Haitian women and engaging in the life of provincial towns. The American racial symbolism Douglas represented was never the most significant element of such a relationship to the Haitians. Douglas often described just what he saw. In his long dispatches to Blaine, he called Hippolyte's reactions to the attempted coup d'etat severe repressive measures. Very much against the actions and positions of the Haitian regime, he made a strong case for the principle of diplomatic asylum, as the bloodshed resulted in filling the legations and consulates with refugees. By his count, 21 refugees sought safety at the U.S. legation and in Douglas's own house. They embarked on a French steamer to safety in Kingston, Jamaica. Without equivocation, the minister offered an earnest American judgment about Haitian political violence. "The real remedy will be found," he wrote on June 17th, "when this people shall have worked their way out of the habit of irregular and violent changes of government, and shall come to a full respect for the independence and impartiality of their courts of justice." Douglas criticized Haitian politics, all the while performing as a kind of protector of its history. This became a balancing act he could not sustain. Increasingly, the Douglases were eager to leave Haiti. Douglas planned to resign his position, but on his own terms and by his own timing, not under the assault of American newspapers, many of which blamed him even for the May Rebellion. As early as February 7, 1891, the Washington Bee claimed Douglas was about to resign under pressure. The minister had to remain largely mum about such matters publicly, but in letters to his sons, he opened up with blunt honesty, providing templates for his more formal self-defenses written later. He was, as always, worried about the health and finances of the extended family. In a late February letter to Charles, he expressed hope that Frederick Jr. was about to get work. He would not yet give the Bee's editor the satisfaction of Douglas's leaving his post. "I shall take my own time for resigning," wrote Douglas confidentially. "The aspirants for the place must wait a little longer." In April, he told Charles at length about his deep consternation with Girardi and Clyde over the coaling station, the steamship line, and its attendant bribes, with which he would not associate. He complained of the racism among those who wished him out of their way. Somewhat petulantly, he also maintained he had been selected to bear the blame for failure of American policy. And in March, to his oldest son, Louis, Douglas especially wrote of family distress. He was particularly anxious about how Frederick made out in obtaining the situation. Douglas recounted how Helen was sick with rheumatic fever. His own health, too, suffered in the Haitian climate. He felt weak, worn out, and too far from home. Douglas probably already suffered symptoms of heart disease, whether he knew it or not. My absence from home has been marked by so many changes, wrote the patriarch, and some of them so distressing that I feel quite easily alarmed when I am told of ailments in our circle. His first wife, most of his old abolitionist friends, so many grandchildren, and one daughter-in-law had already died. More tragedies were yet to come. It was time once again to try retirement if he could. On June 27, 1891, Frederick and Helen took the steamer Prince Willem III to New York. 3 days later, from Cedar Hill, Douglas wrote a brief, formal resignation letter to President Harrison. Douglas's Haitian sojourn was over, but not his defense of it, nor his relationship to the island nation. Upon his return to the United States, and after his resignation, Douglas gave numerous interviews. One of the longest was with an unidentified black reporter for the New York World on July 12th. The reporter arrived at Cedar Hill while parts of the Douglas's family were playing croquet in the backyard. The two men sat on a bench in the summer heat before the host took him indoors. In this and other interviews and essays, Douglas made a forceful self-defense of his work in Haiti, blaming the failure of the coaling station policy, especially on Girardi, and Clyde's quest for money and monopoly. But he especially counterattacked against the New York press that had held him personally responsible. He portrayed himself as the victim of outrageous attacks full of innuendo. There are certain convenient forms under which a thousand lies may lurk in safety, he said, such as, it is said, it is rumored, it is generally believed to be true, it is an open secret. They are all convenient formulas under which to hide a slander. Such language had been used against him and against Haiti. He defended Hippolyte as perhaps unwise, but justly protecting his regime from violent disorder. Douglas called it nonsense that he or Bassett might have done anything to prevent the rebellion and bloodshed on May 28th. In a Washington Post interview, Douglas argued that he had worked assiduously to obtain Mont Saint-Nicolas, but that for political reasons, Haitian leaders simply could not relinquish land or harbors to foreign powers. His most forceful self-defense came in two remarkable articles in September and October in the North American Review. Freed from diplomatic restraint, Douglas fought back for his reputation, especially against the grosser errors of what he deemed a racist press and their commercial and political allies determined to blame him for the debacle of U.S. policy in Haiti. He made no apologies for defending himself, and at this stage of his life, he was particularly sensitive to preserving his historical legacy. He had a duty to respond forcefully, he said, because the charges vitally affect one's standing with the people and the government of one's country. The two articles vented pent-up anger. In such a case, a man must defend himself, Douglas wrote, if only to demonstrate his fitness to defend anything else. The great autobiographer and symbol of his race had much at stake. He had been accused of slothfulness, indifference, excessive sympathy for Haiti, all but disloyalty to the United States, and a general incompetence that some papers were all too willing to attribute to his race. The proud Douglas did as he had always done. He took to his pen and wrote a personal manifesto. He delivered point-by-point rebuttals of specific charges about moments in the negotiations. But most important, he counterattacked about race. Too many reporters, safely behind desks and the comfort of consensus, white racial prejudice, openly stated that, "My failure is my color." He had heard all of this a thousand times before. But the hyper-public nature of this episode required the kind of irony and reversal at which Douglas excelled. Many in power in press and government thought it monstrous to compel Black Haiti to receive a minister as black as herself. "Racism sets all logic at defiance," Douglas wrote from experience. If the United States had sent a distinguished white diplomat, would his American contempt for the colored race at home fit him to win the respect and goodwill of colored people abroad? Or would he play the hypocrite and pretend to love Negroes in Haiti when he is known to hate Negroes in the United States? Douglas did not always paint whites with such a broad brush, but he did with fervor in this case. with a subtlety that hardly made his enemies blink, Douglas argued that as long as white supremacy lay at the root of American foreign affairs, the country could never achieve noble aims abroad. The racial assumption that a white minister could woo the Haitians flew in the face of plain facts. Girardi and Clyde had both spectacularly failed, but also showed only contempt for the Haitians. "Is the weakness of a nation a reason for robbing it?" Douglas asked. "Are we to wring from it by dread of our power what we cannot obtain by appeals to its justice and reason?" This was not the voice of diplomatic dispatches, nor of formal interviews. It was the old declarative abolitionist fire. Douglas knew he was not living back in the land of the 14th Amendment anymore, and that he could not fully trust his own country. But the former diplomat also vehemently defended his support of expansion. Many reporters attacking him were in their petticoats, he claimed, when he advocated the acquisition of Samaná Bay in Santo Domingo in the early 1870s. He delivered a firm statement of his own brand of idealistic imperialism. "While slavery existed, I was opposed to all schemes of the extension of American power and influence. But since its abolition, I have gone with him who goes farthest for such extension." He placed himself in the long tradition of faith that American foreign policy could represent the enlightened values of the Civil War amendments, of the human rights tradition, of respect for equality before law. If Douglas's approach to American foreign policy had an ideological core, this was it. He understood realpolitik, but preferred enlightened self-interest and the export of anti-slavery values. He had made the case to Firmin and the Haitians that an American presence at the mole and as a commercial power was in their best interests. This made him hardly the first American diplomat to fail at trying to advance a set of self-aware contradictions in a volatile foreign land. He had willfully lived by these contradictions, and his ministry died by them as well. He was a servant serving at least two masters, each of them at war within himself. Douglas further came clean with his contempt for Girardi, whom he accused of all manner of racial slights as well as bungling behavior. Acting like a good soldier as the admiral's subordinate, Douglas admitted that he found his position in the negotiations galling. He reflected that he might have resigned out of honor in midwinter 1891, but that he did not propose to be pushed out of office in this way. Accused of too much sympathy for Haiti, he wrote, "I am not ashamed of that charge," but he steadfastly believed he did his honorable duty to his own country. A year later, when Douglas sat down to update Life and Times, bringing his story up to date with 13 new chapters, three of them covered his experience in Haiti. He believed he could not improve on his two articles in the North American Review and reprinted them almost verbatim as chapters. The Haitian sojourn forms the ending of this final edition of Life and Times. In the book, Douglas summed up his life as both dark and stormy and full of sunshine and joy. He made a painful list of the obstacles overcome. Servitude, persecution, false friends, desertion, and depreciation have not robbed my life of happiness or made it a burden. Haiti hangs uneasily in the balance of that statement. The two most crowning honors, he concluded, were President Harrison's appointment of him as minister to Haiti, and now, just recently, an invitation from President Hippolyte to represent Haiti among all the civilized nations of the globe at the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago. Douglas lived by many of the best elements of ambition and honor. Sometimes it brought out of him a nearly self-destructive hypersensitivity, and sometimes it prompted his best work. In a newspaper interview in August 1891, Douglas was asked about his plans for the future. He answered, "I have labored many years for the advancement of the colored race, and I shall again take up the work. I can talk and I can write. I shall use both of these methods of usefulness until I am summoned hence." Late that summer and through the fall, he lectured many times in Washington and Baltimore, especially in Black Methodist and Baptist churches. In another interview in early September in Baltimore, Douglas remarked that at the age of 74, He had a right to retire, but was unwilling to be an idler. He would devote his remaining time to literary work, preparing for publication reminiscences as a duty I owe to my children and grandchildren, that I may leave it as a monumental record of my life. Such familial motivations were surely true, but the engine of autobiography, updating as well as now defending his famous story, had been the driving force of his literary life for 50 years. Douglas could no more stop crafting his life's narrative than he could cease being the sibylline black man of words. In a ceremonial address at the Asbury Methodist Church in Washington on August 31st, in honor of its minister, the Reverend John W. E. Bowen, Douglas paid a tribute unmistakably self-referential. He announced that he was himself not finished. "Great is the power of human speech," Douglas declared. "By it nations are enlightened and reformed. By it the cause of justice and liberty is defended." Then he invoked his favorite apostle. The words of Paul still rock the world, though spoken 2,000 years ago. Addressing the Reverend Bowen, he pronounced, "Your vocation is to speak the word. There is none higher." With pen and voice, echoing the final sentence of "My bondage and my freedom," the aged reformer still sought to change the world. But the America of the 1890s was a wholly different world of troubles from the 1850s. That fall, and into the winter of 1892, Douglas wrote the more than 100 new pages for Life and Times. He was painfully aware that his memoir now landed in a society riven by escalated and violent racial strife. Had the stories of emancipation and legal equality that he had narrated through his own epic life been eclipsed or destroyed by a new white supremacy as potent as slavery ever was? Was the power of the word, the weapon of language, any longer enough to combat the growing horror of lynching? Could the sage of Cedar Hill remain a relevant spokesman of his people as he defended himself? Were the specter of Jim Crow laws just a new challenge, or a resounding defeat of the revolutions of 1863 and 1868? In February 1892, Douglas wrote to an old abolitionist friend, Marshall Pierce, about the struggles of old age, of losing their anti-slavery comrades who were like trees falling all around us. He also reflected on the daunting task of the new revision of Life and Times. "When I laid down my pen 12 years ago, I thought I had reached the end, not of life, but of autobiographic writing. I have always found it easier to speak than to write. These 10 or 12 years have not been cheerful." Those lines contain multitudes: the passing of Anna, the death of grandchildren and of other kinfolk, the loss of Otley Ossing, the social and familial turbulence over his marriage to Helen Pitts, the many events in a nation's retreat from Reconstruction, the ambivalence of his place as insider functionary in official Washington. "They have been years of reaction and darkness," Douglas went on. "The air has been filled with reconciliations between those who fought for freedom and those who fought for slavery. We have been morally obscuring the difference between right and wrong. The ship of state has been swinging back to its ancient moorings." Here Douglas showed how his private and public rhetoric about memory flowed into each other and informed his worldview. And he worried about his health and stamina to fight on. "Though my eyes are failing, and my hand is not as nimble as it once was," he concluded, "I hope to do some service in writing of this period." With the kind of irony he had always thrived on, the nation of Haiti, as well as the increasing atrocities committed by lynch mobs in America, which he was forced to confront after touring the South, provided the elderly Douglas one last opportunity to rock the world. Chapter 31. If American Conscience Were Only Half Alive. When it is asked why we, blacks, are excluded from the world's Columbian Exposition, the answer is slavery. Frederick Douglass, 1893. Writing in 1901, The great critic William Dean Howells compared Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington favorably as great, if different, black men of their times. Howells thought both men had exhibited cool patience for the challenges of their respective eras, but that the temper of Washington's mind was conservative, while Douglass's was essentially militant. Washington led by mild might, and Douglass was a fighter. These images folded a great deal of historical complexity into typologies of leadership. By 1892, the 74-year-old Douglass and the 36-year-old Washington were surely aware of each other. The two generational transformative leaders were finally about to meet. The famous Normal School at Tuskegee, Alabama, was already 10 years old when its founder came to Washington, D.C. to speak in November of 1891. Because of ill health, Douglass sent Washington a note of regret that he could not attend. The sage of Anacostia wished the young institution builder the best with your lecture and your vocation. By the next spring, Douglass planned a lecture tour in Tennessee, Georgia, and Alabama as the Wizard of Tuskegee worked to get Old Man Eloquent to give the commencement address at his institute. The two former slaves met in Washington on April 27, 1892. On one of Washington's many fundraising and networking trips. 2 days later, on his return to Tuskegee, the principal wrote a black organizer in Montgomery, Alabama, informing him that a plan to have Douglass speak in that city the day before the school's commencement was not acceptable. Ever attentive to the reputation and the funding of Tuskegee, Washington complained that arranging Douglass's visit was a matter of business with a great amount of expense. Washington further groused that he had to pay a man to accompany him, Douglass, on this trip. The principal was frustrated, but determined. It has taken me nearly 6 months to arrange this trip, and I have had to bring pressure to bear from a very large number of sources in order to get Mr. Douglass to come. The famed abolitionist was still getting $100 to $150 for his speeches in most venues, plus his travel expenses. Washington wrote to Douglass on April 29th to finalize the plan and make sure in no uncertain terms that the orator would not speak anywhere else in Alabama before the commencement. Washington wanted Douglass's imprimatur at Tuskegee without any competing publicity. The evolution of the old abolitionist's visit to Tuskegee demonstrates the wide difference between the leadership styles and purposes of the two leaders. Washington was ever the marketer of his institution, its security and interests. Douglass was at this late stage in life, the celebrity courted to appear and speak, sometimes through elaborate planning. Both men would always be remembered as national black leaders, but in different nations, in different eras. Washington built the remarkable Tuskegee, the Negro Business League, and other institutions. Douglass was in some ways his own Tuskegee. Douglass's spring 1892 speaking tour began first with lectures in New York, Boston, and Asbury Park, New Jersey, in March. Then in May, he took the train south to Tennessee, where he spoke in Knoxville, Nashville, and Chattanooga, May 18th to 21st. On May 23rd, he spoke at a church in Atlanta, as well as to the black graduates at the Atlanta University commencement. 3 days later, and 130 miles southwest by rail, he was in Tuskegee as Washington's special guest. 9 men and 6 women with an average age of 21 graduated that day. The men went forth, according to a press report, into farming, sawmill work, carpentry, wheelwriting, and printing, while the women had prepared for sewing, cooking, and housekeeping. As part of the day's ceremonies, the cornerstone was laid for a new Bible training school. The scene, recorded another reporter, was most picturesque, with a crowd of at least 5,000 people arriving in wagons, in carts, in ox teams, on horseback, on muleback, and on foot. As the throng filled the school grounds, Douglass delivered a version of the self-made men speech. A journalist called the address calm and dispassionate, as Douglass preached a customary cluster of economy, thrift, and common sense. Douglass once again urged the larger white society to let us alone and give us a fair chance, but be sure you do give us a fair chance. A stunning photograph survives of the orator standing on a stage in the round, flanked by a tightly packed audience. American flags aplenty throughout the pavilion. Douglas had taken the decades-old, let alone dictum, and his doctrine of self-reliance to the new Mecca, Booker T. Washington's industrial school in the heart of Cotton Belt, Alabama. Just what Douglas thought of this extraordinary experience at Tuskegee, he did not publicly record. But thousands of Southern blacks in the heart of the old Confederacy had now seen and heard Douglas, the living legend whose life and words had long provided a mythic backdrop to the shamanism of the Tuskegee founder. The next day, the traveling orator was in Montgomery, Alabama, speaking to yet another black audience. Then he boarded another train for the long ride back north to Rochester, where on Memorial Day, May 30th, he joined President Benjamin Harrison to dedicate a Civil War soldier's monument in his old hometown. He and Harrison returned to Washington, D.C. on an overnight train, where on the 31st, Douglas gave an interview at Cedar Hill to an Indianapolis reporter about the impending 1892 Republican National Convention. He fully supported Harrison for renomination, stressing that this president had vigorously supported the Federal Elections Bill of 1890, which narrowly failed in Congress, at creating renewed action to protect black voters in the South. The reporter could not resist physical descriptions of the venerable Douglas, the old white-haired, colored patriot, who when the breezes of Maryland blew about his shoulders, his long, white, fluffy locks made him appear the embodiment of all that could be pure and wise in man. Douglas returned the flight of rhetoric, declaring Harrison the best president since Lincoln. With barely enough time to repack a bag, Douglas was off again on the long journey to Minneapolis for the Republican convention, where he performed not as a delegate, but as a symbolic presence. During his tour of the South, Douglas could not have yet known that 1892 would suffer the most recorded lynchings, 230 total, 161 blacks, 69 whites, of any year over the more than half century that the Tuskegee Institute archives kept its famous records. What he did soon know is that in March, a white mob had destroyed the offices of the Memphis Free Speech, leading to the lynchings of three black businessmen and the rapid emergence of a young anti-lynching and civil rights activist named Ida B. Wells. Douglas soon met this extraordinary woman, who in her own way reinvigorated the aging leader's career, as she also challenged him. At the 1892 Republican Convention in June, President Harrison was renominated, and Douglas joined other stalwarts in keeping his shoulder loyally to the stone of party unity. He saw no alternative to Harrison at the raucous convention, and, as always, pledged to stump wherever Republicans would send him. But that spring and summer, an increasingly exhausted Douglas was deluged at times with requests to lecture, as well as write for journals. He also heard frequently from old friends and from people he did not know with complaints and advice. Old comrade Martha Green sewed Douglas a dressing gown and urged him upon his return from the Minneapolis convention to take a vacation and hoped he was not wholly used up. All of these matters were normal in old age, but some must have deeply affected him. Elizabeth Cady Stanton wrote in early 1892 about how her movement for women's suffrage had made some progress, but that it felt like a horrible tax on human patience to be 40 years going through this moral wilderness with no pillar of light to lead the way. She wished for a golden calf whose ears and tails and legs could provide us the means of war. Julia Crofts wrote in June, wishing the busy Frederick would write to her more often. She described her ill health and dwindling income. Her husband had died some time ago, and she was lonely. "Think of me always as your old true friend," she begged, and urged Douglas to persist till our work is done. His old friend and once employer of two of Douglas's sons, H.O. Wagoner, in Denver, wrote to say he had suffered blindness, but still had someone to read to him an essay the old abolitionist had written. Ellen Richardson from England, who had led the campaign to purchase Douglas's freedom, wrote to urge him to bear down on revising Life and Times, because it was fitting employment in old age. But Douglas, despite fatigue and likely the beginning of arterial heart disease, now had at least three jobs. As professional Republican, as commissioner for Haiti to the Chicago exhibition, including planning and funding of the Haitian pavilion, and still as patriarch and provider for his troubled extended family. In June, after returning from the Republican convention, he wrote to a friend that even after 4 days, he had not yet gotten over the strain put upon my nerves by the political event. He felt in constant demand and inadequate to the challenge. He complained that now he could not stand the excitement of the crowd as he once had. He further had to suffer hearing himself referred to as an old man. But there was still much work to do in the time I have. He planned to spend up to 6 months in Chicago at the exposition the following year, and famous friends kept prodding him to keep up the fight. Douglas still had to be Douglas as best he could. The demands of fame and influence constantly beckoned. A colored boy, 18 years of age, from Natchitoches, Louisiana, named Edward Wright, wrote in 1892 asking Douglas for advice on where he might secure a splendid education, north or south, and where he can get his legal rights. He wanted the great man to help him make a man of myself. In a long letter, a 17-year-old black girl from Omaha, Nebraska, Augusta Johnson, begged Douglas to financially support her effort to go to Tennessee Central College in Nashville. She currently had to work for her ill sister and family, and did not want to be a servant anymore. "I have broader ideas than that," Miss Johnson asserted with confidence. She and her sister had read Life and Times and yearned for attention from the author. "Girls have to be so particular about where they are and what they do," wrote this child of Reconstruction. Sometimes groups in the Deep South, such as one in Louisiana in June 1892, wrote to inform Douglas, the hero of the race, of the depths of oppression they faced. Their ballots suppressed, with no one representing them, in desperate need of physical protection, they beseeched the old leader to try to influence Congress. Naming only their parish, Terrebonne, they declared themselves afraid to sign their names. In the face of these requests and more, Douglas felt essentially helpless. His correspondence could be both heartening and heartbreaking. But the wave of lynchings prompted him to take up the pen. In July 1892, he published Lynch Law in the South in the North American Review. Douglas tried to maintain composure as he developed an analysis of why lynching mobs seemed so shockingly ubiquitous across the South. But outrage and despair crept out of his words. Controversially, he suggested that even if some black men, like men of other races, had committed a rape, lynching provided merely an effort to neutralize one poison by the employment of another. A howling mob, ritually executing a man in public without judge or jury, he wrote, is the real crime and the destruction of law and order. The alleged act of sexual outrage, Douglas maintained, was a mere excuse for violence against blacks. He still claimed a hope in good white people in the South, but acknowledged that too many in the mobs have eyes but see not, ears but hear not, and they rush to their work of death as pitilessly as the tiger rushes upon his prey. The beast in the dark recesses of the human psyche was in the mob, not in the victim of ritual violence. Douglas reminded his readers that the crime of rape had for more than 200 years been committed by white men against black women with no redress. Protecting the purity of white women only provided yet another excuse to hide real causes. Douglas believed lynching occurred because blacks had made so much progress and were becoming prosperous. The Negro meets no resistance when on a downward course, but when he shakes off his rags and wretchedness and presumes to be a man, he contradicts this popular standard and becomes an offense to his surroundings. Douglas also asserted that during the Civil War, with white men gone to the battlefronts, many blacks were left on plantations with white women and no such sexual attacks occurred. So evolved Douglas's argument, made more fully in the coming 2 years, that lynching was a murderous, lawless, anarchic form of racial and social control, justified by racist canards. He offered two answers, one of hope and one of fear. The hope, expressed somewhat lamely, was in the law, the courts, and the good men and women of the South who might rise up and stop such horrors. The fear, however, stated in the old abolitionist line that oppression can make a wise man mad, smoldered in the prospect of black retaliatory violence. Those who sow the wind will reap the whirlwind, Douglas warned with a trusted Old Testament maxim. He reached into his well of 1850s hope from the slavery crisis, faith placed in the best of human nature, in progress, in the Constitution, in evil that sows good through tragedy. But not much hope emerged from the lynching crisis of the 1890s. Despair of another kind visited Douglas and his family in late July 1892. After his wife, Virginia, died in 1889, Frederick Douglass Jr.'s life spiraled downward. He had always struggled financially. Now his health collapsed. In September of the previous year, Frederick Jr. had checked into Freedman's Hospital at Howard University for surgery. He suffered with respiratory disease, and now, on July 26th, he died at age 50 of what the era called consumption, or what the 20th century knew as pulmonary tuberculosis. A funeral took place on the 28th at Frederick Jr.'s home in Hillsdale, District of Columbia, where on the same property for some years he had operated a grocery. According to a press report, the elder Douglas requested the ceremonies be kept brief and simple. Many friends gathered around a casket in the parlor. A quartet from an AME church sang Rock of Ages, and the Reverend Francis Jesse Peck officiated. The elder Douglas did not speak. A carriage transported the deceased to Graceland Cemetery, where he was buried next to Anna Murray Douglas, his mother. Although comforted by Helen and his other three children, this death of a son, in the wake of so many lost grandchildren, tested Douglas's emotional condition as few events had before. His sons had for so long been a source of pride and personal travail. Virtually nothing survives in his words of what this loss meant to him. Duty beckoned all around as he quietly mourned. Douglas received numerous condolence letters from friends and acquaintances, but some came as sympathy couched in demands on his time and invitations to lecture, including details of train schedules. Some seemed to genuinely care about the father's grief, while others could not hide their desire for the orator's performance. And the begging letters still arrived as well. Two young black men, in dire circumstances, one a poor man without any parents, wrote in September, asking Douglas to help them get into Howard University. Douglas had trained his sons as printers, but they never enrolled at Howard. Rock of Ages, cleft for me, let me hide myself in thee. Could my tears forever flow? Could my zeal no longer know? Douglas could not hide, nor did he intend to. His rock had broken apart many times before. He had to be a rock for family and for the race. By August and September, he was off on speaking tours for the election campaign and in frequent correspondence and planning for the Haitian Pavilion at the Chicago World's Fair. Sometime that summer of 1892, he finally met Ida B. Wells, striking up an activist friendship that would animate his remaining years. Douglas was well aware of this extraordinary but young and vulnerable radical woman. He took on a fatherly mentor role toward her from the beginning, and she welcomed his support. From their first encounter, she saw Douglas as a heroic model, but one she felt safe in criticizing as well as adoring. Wells, who had fled Memphis and her native Mississippi for safety after writing bitter diatribes about lynchers and their acts, contemplated a tour of England to spread her cause. Douglas counseled her to take to the speaking and journalistic writing circuit with all the courage and energy she could muster. He had told his people's story as no other. Now she would be that person on the searing cause of anti-lynching. For 2 years, they made a historic, if sometimes volatile, team. Wells considered herself, nevertheless, only a mouthpiece about the lynching story, whereas Douglas she considered the true orator. Douglas wrote a public letter in October that Wells employed as an imprimatur in both of her famous books, Southern Horrors and The Red Record, each first published in 1892 and 1895, respectively. She also invoked Douglass's recommendation in sensitive situations, where her veracity and gender equality were challenged. He, in turn, thanked Wells for her experience.